FM.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Their goal is to destroy all existing religions save theirs, all existing governments save theirs, and shackle the mob in a system of eternal oppressive debt chained to a computer for the rest of their life, in a propagandized world to make them believe that they are happy in this system.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. If there's a nuclear accident down at Hinkley Point, the fallout cloud may, whether or not they tell us, be heading for Bristol. Hundreds of ordinary people in the southwest are continuing to give up their free time to campaign against the new nuclear power station. So why are they committed to stopping it going ahead? And what are the solutions they would like to see to keep the lights on? Also, the US and UK intelligence services are out of control. We hear from former MI5 officer Annie Machon on how the intelligence services break the law with impunity and what we can do to stop them on our home computers. Plus, Martin Summers' weekly tour of the world's hotspots. But we start where we left off, that is with Liberal Democrat councillor in the Cotswolds, Esmond Jenkins. Now, Esmond, we were just getting into some of the issues affecting you personally, but tell us a little bit about the whole process of the auditing, because this is where these things are supposed to be picked up. When things go wrong, surely the auditors are supposed to come in, aren't they, and have a look through the books and say, well, this didn't work and that didn't work. What was your experience of whether the auditors actually did their job or not?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, we've had seven investigations, and I think the first audit commission inquiry was in 2008. It raised some valid questions, didn't get proper answers from very senior managers at the county council, but was pulled up. In 2010, after the fraud had broken the surface and... the chief executive of Cotswold District Council announced a independent review of the water park and launched the council's own audit team under the direction of Robert Milford to look at every aspect of the Cotswold water park scandal and how it impinged upon the council. And at the outset, I was supposed to help him set the brief because I was the one councillor who had been instrumental in exposing the fraud in the water park. And I'd raised concerns over the business dealings and the business relationships between colleagues in the council and those who were closely connected to the fraud in the water park. So that was my expectation. As it was, I was never actually called by the auditor to help him set the brief. And then it transpired, surprise, surprise, that actually the auditor hadn't looked at the Conservative councillors who I had concerns about. What he'd had done was look at 400 plus emails of mine to the chief executive officer, the CEO, and the leader of the council, and it was his evidence that helped to substantiate a disciplinary complaint against me.
So that sounds a bit strange. People actually doing the investigating weren't actually started to not focus on what they were supposed to be investigating, but look at you instead. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, it's a pretty incredible tale we've heard here from Esmond over what is actually a very important natural resource, something that we would expect that our local authorities looking after. They're clearly not.
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, the detail has been fascinating. But what strikes me is the possibility that this isn't just a one-off fraud, but that the failures to investigate run, you know, through the police force and possibly in directions like that. So we're not just talking about a particular case. It may be that it's exposed failings in the whole system of making sure that planning is done properly and transparently.
Now, I know one of the connections between all sorts of people in public life, and including the police, city councillors, council officers, county councillors, etc., is Freemasonry. A lot of them are in the same lodges. Have you actually found any evidence that of involvement through Freemasonry, where somebody may be benefiting, and also know someone else in their own lodge who was involved in potentially investigating this?
The issue of Freemasonry, it really underpins the whole water park scandal. In 2008, before I became, it was just after I'd been elected as a councillor, I had a meeting in the council buildings, and a very senior officer agreed with me that the council knew they had a problem with Freemasonry. That was a private conversation I had with him. But he subsequently denied making those claims. What I would say is that something has to be linking local authorities, the commercial interests in the water park, the planning process, and latterly the police.
But I mean, isn't it possible that this is just conversations had down the pub saying, well, I'm a friend of yours, I can fix this for you? I mean, it doesn't have to be Freemasonry, surely. It doesn't have to be involved at all.
No, but it could be any number of associations. But there is, I would argue, if you look at the Serious Fraud Office's website and you start, one of the key telltales of fraud and corruption is when decisions start to cease to follow any logic. You know, irrational decisions are made at various levels. And the whole story of the Cotswold Water Park scandal is the systemic failure of local authority officers to do anything about it. And when they are challenged, they simply deny any knowledge when the evidence suggests otherwise. This was why we brought in the police. I raised the second complaint that Gloucestershire Police Force had not conducted anything approaching a rigorous investigation in 2010. They had a four-week review. They agreed with me, and they brought in the City of London Police. That was a further 15-month police investigation, which I've got to say, at the end of which, I don't think was any more rigorous than the first one. I think senior police officers have been very careful in focusing the investigation off-centre to make sure that those in positions of political power and influence have not come under any suspicion.
So, but have you actually any evidence whatsoever that Freemasons are involved?
Well,
had any testimony from anybody, for example?
Only from local people. We know people who've worked for various individuals who say, yes, he's a Freemason. You know, before I became well known in the water park, shaking hands with people is a reasonable telltale of where they are, and then observing the linkages between individuals at the in public meetings, I think, is another who comes in to help who. Something, whether it's Freemasonry or some other connection, something has to explain the systemic failure of investigation after investigation to point to the complicity of local authority officials.
it's interesting, Martin, bringing in the City of London police to investigate this, because they're almost like their own sort of separate jurisdiction, and they don't really seem to have done very well when it comes to investigating crimes happening in the city. For example, LIBOR fraud. We've had more recently the problems with foreign exchange fraud. We've had payment protection insurance fraud. We've also had vast amounts of money laundering going on by banks in the city, and the City of London police seem to have been very, very relaxed with their handcuffs.
Well, I don't know enough to make a solid comment about this, but I think what the patterns are becoming increasingly clear when you look at local level with a relatively small a level of corruption in the water park, relatively small. Of course, for the local people, that's a big issue. But I think what's really happening is that we've got a deregulated environment now for this kind of behaviour, and we've reached a point with the City of London, the city as an institution, where if they start prosecuting individuals, they'll have to prosecute everybody. They can't prosecute everybody, so they don't prosecute anybody. And senior economists in the US are saying that they're expecting thousands of people to be sent to prison. That hasn't happened. That's what happened in the 1980s with the savings and loan scandal. The Icelanders have sent their bankers to prison this week. If it doesn't happen, something's amiss. It should happen.
Author Martin Short, journalist Martin Short, used to work on World in Action, the defunct Granada TV documentary series, and he wrote a book called Inside the Brotherhood. Here he is talking about police and the City of London and their involvement with Freemasonry.
I don't want to give the impression that however many Freemasons there are in this country now, or a good deal less than it used to be, that they're all policemen. In fact, Freemasonry is full of people in many walks of life, and also, by and large, these days dedicated lodges for police officers would not be encouraged, though there is in fact one called the St. James's Lodge in central London, which is entirely staffed by police officers. However, in an average lodge, you might get people from any walk of life, and in among them might be a police officer. Now, it would be a sore temptation, bearing in mind the oaths of mutual defence and support that Freemasons undertake, if you were in trouble, whether it's over a parking ticket or a drunken driving offence or, some punch up with a neighbour, that you might hope that you could turn to a brother as a Mason in distress, and favours would follow, that maybe bits of paper could be lost and you could avoid prosecution. I think that's a bit more difficult these days, but of course what used to be common practice, you can't be absolutely sure doesn't happen now.
What about the City of London? Because I know back in the 1980s you had a good look at the death of the banker Roberto Calvi. Now, a lot of people now are looking at the City of London and thinking, can we trust the banking fraternities, and can we trust these big investment banks that seem to have such a lot of power over our futures at the moment?
There is absolutely no doubt that Freemasonry used to be extremely strong in the City of London. We obtained a lodge list of all the Lord Mayor's Lodge in London, and universally, one after another, over about 70 years, the Lord Mayors of London were masters of this lodge. In fact, some of them were initiated only after they had become Lord Mayor. Unfortunately, I haven't been blessed by being handed another copy of the Guildhall Lodge members list.
That was author and journalist Martin Short there. He was his book, very well worth reading, is Inside the Brotherhood, about Freemasonry. Now I'm joined by Esmond Jenkins-Still, the Lib Dem councillor in the Cotswolds. Now, Esmond, I know that as part of the police investigation, you actually put in your witness statement the names of 10 council officers and individual councillors that you believed, you had reason to believe, either evidence from elsewhere or handshaking, this kind of thing, that were actually Freemasons. What happened? Did the police investigate to see whether those people were in similar lodges, knew each other through Freemasonry and had some kind of connection outside their official office?
No, I mean, this goes back to September 2011 when I was invited to a meeting at Gloucestershire Police Headquarters by Kevin Lambert, who was one of the Assistant Chief Police Officers. And he listened, to my concerns over the first round police investigation. And it was to Kevin Lambert that I said, look, it's my belief that Freemasonry has is at work, you know, in some form. I drew the observation, or drew upon the observation, that the Cotswold Waterbot is basically a mining area. It's a quarrying area. And Cirencester had five lodges. It's well known as being a centre historically of Freemasonry, and that Freemasonry is very much centred on the quarrying activity post-war. So observations and challenges which I'd made, because I went into meetings with statutory declarations. I challenged a number of senior county councillors who they wouldn't deny it or confirm it. But they certainly would not agree to signing a statutory declaration declaring whether they were or weren't Freemasons. So, you know, I'd just like to emphasise, you know, historically my family were Freemasons, so this is not something that I'm not, my father wasn't, but I don't believe all Freemasons are wicked or corrupt. But something has to explain the systemic failure to get to the truth of what really went on. Who was involved behind and in addition to Dennis Grant in the water park? Because it conceivably couldn't be just one person. It had to involve far more influential characters.
Now, I know you've drawn yourself parallels with things like the Hillsborough cover-up. I mean, how do you justify that?
Yeah. Now, look, I've had pretty forthright meetings, long meetings with very senior police officers, and I've been abused verbally by them. They've tried to basically shut me up, and I've said no. Look, what we've embarked upon, what we've tried to expose in the water park, is systemic corruption. And the one observation I do make is that people in authority, supposedly respectable people, knights of the realm included, have turned a blind eye. They've walked past on the other side of the street. And that, I think, is probably the one thing that I will take to my grave. That, I've said quite openly and directly to this police officer, that if we cannot trust them, if they operate an a la carte justice system locally in Gloucestershire, they chase after some people but not others, depending on their associations, then that isn't justice at all, and that is a fast route for police to lose the respect and the trust of the community. And I think that's where we are.
But I mean, isn't it the situation that rich people, powerful people, organised criminals, for example, will always want to be in the police, be friendly to the police, and be influencing them?
Well, Savile probably tells us that. I mean, you drew upon the Hillsborough example, and I think that is a very powerful example, because, you know, from what I've learned, because I come from Liverpool originally, I know something of the outrage that people felt that the system had failed them. And eventually, the only route to justice was for the victims and the family of the victims to appoint their own investigation team. And it was only then, led by the Bishop of Liverpool and not police officers, that the truth was unearthed. And I think I've used that example and I've hammered it back to Gloucestershire Police that, you know, I don't think informed people do or can trust the police. I think the Mitchell affair and the Leveson inquiry all point to the same suspicions.
So, as someone who's been to hell and back with this story, obviously it still occupies quite a lot of your time, a great deal of courage to continue taking it on and not to do what these various people are trying to persuade you to do and just back off and forget about it. What advice would you have for changes that would actually bring about a much better system, and actually to get justice in these cases. You know, what are there any sort of tweaks that you'd like to see system to actually make sure that the police are doing their jobs in cases like this?
My observation and my comment, certainly in a relatively middle class area such as the Cotswold District, is that people are far too trusting. They're too trusting and they're too disinterested in the local authority system. You know, you vote for people according to the colour of their the flag that they fly under. That is not the right way. We should. The one thing I've learned from all of this is that, you know, I'm not really interested in people's politics. I'm interested in the person. If I can trust that person, I can live with the politics. And you know, there are too many people in positions of responsibility who receive very handsome salaries from the taxpayer who simply have not done the job. Some of them have gone further. Some of them, I believe, were party to setting me up for this disciplinary process. So, you know, I would say to electorates, get involved, ask questions, and vote for people who you feel you can trust in. Don't vote for people simply because they represent one party or another. And then beyond that, I would say, as somebody who a very senior Conservative in Oxfordshire once said to me quite recently, that the whole commissioner process was not something that he believed in, but the Andrew Mitchell debacle proves that the police, left to their own devices, can't be trusted. And I've got to say, as somebody who would have been on the opposite side of the fence 5 years ago, I believe that concern is absolutely valid. And I think, you know, senior police officers are politicised, they are career driven, and, you know, do they tell the truth? Well, frankly, not enough. So, you know, I think what we need are more people to stand up and challenge.
And how do we ensure that our police services, you know, that there isn't this kind of a temptation for people at senior levels in the police service to turn a blind eye to things?
Well, you know, I don't think there's an easy solution. I think I've wasted huge amounts of time and large sums of money trying to do the job of other people. I've gone to the police twice, and I think we've drawn a blank twice, not because there isn't sufficient evidence, but because whoever's pulling the strings at Gloucestershire Police doesn't want the real culprits exposed. You know, whether that's Freemasonry or political allegiance or some other motivation, I don't know. But I know that there is evidence of bribery and corruption in the water park, and it's centred on the planning process, and yet nobody's been brought to account.
And for anybody that's also suspicious about planning decisions, is there anything that you could say that would help them to figure out whether there is corruption involved or not?
Yeah, I mean, you have to. I mean, I had the advantage. I wasn't working as a lawyer, so I could spend time sitting in local authority meetings and watching how they work. And I would encourage people at all levels, at all ages, the younger the better, to get it, you know, get in there, look how dysfunctional they are. And you'll see how they work, and ask questions, because the one thing that has helped us has been publicity. The people who are up to these up to skullduggery do not like the spotlight being turned on them, and that is the power ultimately of the press, and particularly of the private eye, because it is widely read. But it's publicity which is, I think, the weapon of choice. And you know, to do that, you need to be prepared to engage, find out, and take a stand.
Well, Lib Dem councillor Esmond Jenkins from over in the Cotswolds. A fascinating insight into some of the corruption going on. In fact, as we heard, the biggest case dealt with by Private Eye since the Paulson affair. And we're going to finish with a listen now to an explanation by Martin Short. What is Freemasonry?
Much is made of the fact Rudyard Kipling and his lodge in India was ecumenical. people from any religion could join. You know, Christian, Muslim, Jew, Sikh, you know, Zoroastrian, anyway. Anyone who believed in a single God, you see, the only stipulation was it should be monotheistic. But once you get above the third degree, it's all Christian in a kind of perverse form. It's all fictive. It's all a miasma of legend and lies, you know. And it's like a pyramid sales operation, Freemasonry, because you have to keep on going up all these ranks in the hope that one day you will find the secret, the absolute kernel secret of Freemasonry. But as we've seen, they change the actual, you know, magic word. The words that you're told up to a certain level are the secret words of the science of Freemasonry. You're told, oh, no, it's not like that at all, you know. You've been led down the garden path. I mean, it is a bit like a pyramid sales operation, and of course it does cost you a huge amount of money.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Now, hundreds of ordinary people in the southwest are continuing to give up their free time to campaign against the proposed new nuclear power station at Hinkley Point near Bridgewater, and I'm joined now by Nikki, who's one of the campaigners. Hi, Nikki, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony.
Tell us how you got into campaigning around nuclear issues.
Well, I live in a town called Bridgewater in Somerset, and just after I had my son, the house that I moved into, I discovered that at the end of the road where I lived was this massive like crane, and it's where they move nuclear waste from the lorries that take it from the power station to transfer it to Sellafield, right next to the school that my son went to, and so that's when I started to get involved.
Now that sounds a bit bizarre. So they're bringing the nuclear waste by road right into the centre of Bridgewater. I mean, the idea, obviously, Hinkley is way out of the way, so that it's away from people, and if there's anything dangerous happens, it's away from a population centre. But they're taking actually the most radioactive waste right into the middle of Bridgewater. And are you still living there, or did you move somewhere else in the town?
You can't move far enough away, can you? I think it's obviously only about protecting populations in places like London and maybe possibly Bristol. It seems that the population in Bridgewater is irrelevant.
Well, I mean, Dumble, for example, is just outside Bridgewater. There's no reason why, for example, they couldn't stick a little railhead in Dumble, and if they're going to move it there, they can move that there by road quite safely, and it's away from a population centre. It seems to me they're saying that actually these nuclear flasks, which contain the spent fuel rods, which intensely radioactive, that they're quite safe.
Well, actually, what they're saying, Tony, it's an interesting point that you make, because every other nuclear power station in this country, in England and in Wales, have their own, well, I don't know about Wales actually, but definitely in England, they all have their own railheads within the station grounds. So I don't know if it was a cost cutting thing, but for me, it raises an issue about accountability, because I think that the people in Somerset have been sold short by the local authorities, by the politicians, in allowing the stations to be built without such a facility.
Yeah, when I came on the phone to you, Nikki, to try and persuade you to come up here, which you've done, thank you very much for today, you were actually inside some kind of suit, nuclear protection suit. What were you doing?
Oh, crikey. We were probably protesting, I would imagine, if I was wearing a suit, as we're prone to doing. Remind me when we were.
Well, this is just a few weeks ago. And I phoned you and you said, I can't really speak to you with the phone because I've got a nuclear protection suit on.
Oh, yeah. I was dressed as... I had a radioactive waste barrel suit on, and I was actually in London. And I'd gone down there because right now the government are consulting, apparently, if you can believe that, they're consulting about what to do with the waste. And so, as your listeners may or may not be aware, the government's plans to build a tranche of new nuclear power stations are resting on the government's belief that a geological disposal facility will exist to accept all the waste. Now, we've got a legacy of like 70 years worth of waste in a really bad state in Sellafield. And, you know, never mind the legacy waste. We haven't even sorted out the legacy waste, never mind creating somewhere that could accept new build waste. And so they had a process, which, again, as every process they've ever had about the radioactive waste, it always seems to want to dump it in Cumbria. So they don't want to move it very far. They just want to get it off the Sellafield site and dumped very close to Sellafield. Cumbria a very pro-nuclear local authorities. Actually, the Cumbria County Council, I think, Sellafield's something like an employer of about 10,000 people. So it's a very big employer in a very remote area. So people are very dependent on them. So even though they wanted to host the dump, they didn't actually feel able to because of the lack of information, the lack of clarity, the lack of suitable geology. So we went to London and we took a big banner that read, "How about a nuclear waste dump here?" And we stood outside Parliament and we stood outside Buckingham Palace and we stood a few places with this high-vis coloured barrels and banners on.
Okay.
And that's what we're doing.
Now, I've also heard recently, I think it's just this week, that the local authority up in Cumbria, where Sellafield, where all this nuclear waste ends up, have decided they don't want the nuclear waste to end up. Now, this has left the government in a bit of a difficult situation because they have nowhere to put this waste. Nobody wants it.
Well, the undertone of it, Tony, actually, is that I think they intend to do just as the German government has done and to impose it on a community. You know, nuclear academics and experts from all over the world for about the last 20 years have all said that one of the obstacles to us sorting out the problem of the legacy waste, the legacy, if people don't understand what I mean by legacy, is the radioactive waste that we've already made. So it's here, we can't put it back in the box, so to speak, so we have to do something with that waste. And what the experts argue is that every time we try to look into what to do with that waste, over-ambitious industry people or politicians all decide to use that search as a justification to produce more waste. And so every time they try and have a hunt for somewhere, it kind of inevitably the search grinds to a halt, because it's a very different ethical proposition to create more waste when the solutions that they moot for the waste, they're not really solutions. I mean, the government would talk about a geological disposal facility and say, in fact, in their consultation document, they say that a dump will ensure that future generations are protected from that radioactive waste. Now, that is a complete and utter lie. The science around geological disposal is not certain, it's not known, and one of the problems is because it's radioactive for such a long, long time into the future. Now, people like to say tens of thousands of years, they're orders of magnitude wrong. We're talking millions of years, and obviously you can't predict what's going to happen then, and so that creates a huge amount of uncertainty. And so what we know is that when we dump it, eventually it will leak. It doesn't matter how good your containers are, it doesn't matter how good your geology is, eventually that stuff will leak, and it will leak out into the environment, and it will be moved by the water through the rocks over a period of time. And so it's not contested by scientists that a repository leak, what is a hot source of topic is when it will leak and how and what the implications of that will be.
But it's got to go somewhere, hasn't it? Where are you? Any thoughts about where it should go?
I've heard all sorts of ideas, from shooting it into the sun, through dropping it into volcanoes.
Hang on. If you drop it in a volcano, might it come back with a load of boiling rock in your face?
Oh, well, these are the ridiculous ideas that Coram looked at. I mean, they say that Coram was a committee on radioactive waste management that was formed just in around 2003, and it was quite groundbreaking in some ways, although there were a lot of criticisms about some of the appointments and the fact that government appointed them. Some of the work they did about engaging members of the public and stakeholders to find a solution was quite progressive, and they came up and so they said that they started with a clean piece of paper, but they didn't. The ideas for them to look at were already on the table, so they included sticking it in volcanoes, sticking it into subduction zones, shooting it into the
sun.
Hang on,
okay, what's a subduction zone?
Sorry, a subduction zone is where the crust of the earth that is underneath the oceans. So one of the, you all know about earthquakes, and earthquakes happen because of a thing called plate tectonics. So that is, if you imagine the earth's crust as being different plates, they slide around and the heavier ones, the lighter ones get subducted underneath the heavier ones. ones. This tends to happen at the coast. So if you look at the Pacific Rim and Japan, Japan's a very good example. Japan, you've got four different plates meeting. And so the Japan Sea is actually a subduction zone. It's slowly...
So the idea is you plonk them on the seabed, one of these places, and they slowly slide underneath the Earth's crust. Is that the idea?
Kind of, yeah. Except that the processes of subduction are extremely slow, and you know it would leak before it would be, you know, so it wasn't a viable idea. In fact, very little of the ideas they looked at were viable, and as a result of that, so what you have to understand about geological disposal is when they started making nuclear waste, they had a fantasy that some poor schmuck in the future was going to come along and sort it all out. So they didn't pay much attention.
So they were waiting, really saying, well, surely someone's going to come up with a technology to get rid of this.
Technological optimism, yeah, you know, we're human, we're great, we're going to sort this stuff out. They didn't pay much attention to sorting it out, but they did put a lot of effort into making more. And so the nuclear industry, around the 1970s, they started to have a look into this accumulating waste problem that they were starting to get. And ever since the 1970s, the nuclear industry has favoured geological disposal, digging a big hole in the rock and dumping it as a solution. So that's the history. So what we're looking at now is still the nuclear industry's favourite solution. We're opposed to deep geological disposal. We wouldn't say that our position wouldn't change in the future, but in the current state of knowledge, the current research, where things are at now, we do not support that route.
Well, Cumbria doesn't seem to either. I mean, a story on the BBC website from November the 25th this year, nuclear waste repository, Cumbria attacks the government move. Cumbria County Council branded the government's decision to exclude it from discussions over the search for an underground nuclear waste store was outrageous. The authority officially responded to the Department for Energy and Climate Change over the revised search process, which was announced in the summer for a nuclear waste depository. In January, the County Council voted against staying in the talks. The government then enacted district councils to make the decision. In January, the County Council's cabinet voted 7-3 against staying in the process over fears it could not secure the right to withdraw at a later stage. It also wanted firm agreements about community benefits. So there was a democratic process, they say, which was carried out, culminating in a decision at the end of January, but it looks as though the government didn't like that decision, so they're inventing a new process that will exclude that level of council, the county council that took the decision.
Yeah, so that's exactly, so this is why we keep ending up in Cumbria, is because basically that's where the waste already is, and that's where the government wants it to stay. One of the things you have to understand about the Quorum, the Committee on Radioactive Waste Management's original recommendations, is that they said in the current state of knowledge, GDF, it was the best they could come up with, i.e. the other ideas were just so ludicrous as to be quite laughable, like dropping it into volcanoes or shooting it into the sun. So although they said that in the long term that was the best that we could come up with, they also knew that because of the uncertainty, it probably wouldn't be particularly politically possible to cite a GDF, and they acknowledged that. And one of the things that they said was GDF had to be a strategy, but what you had to do first was you had to do storage. You had to build good hardened storage, interim storage. You had to immobilize the waste so for example, in Sellafield, you've got massive ponds full of all sorts of waste. I mean, some of it, the cleanup that they're doing now on the first generation Magnox stuff, 20 years before they can even get the fuel. That's 20 years.
So how much of this high level nuclear waste is there actually hanging around?
Oh, you're going to ask me statistics now, and I'm not going to be able to pull them off the top of my head. I think it's about 100, maybe about 100 tonnes, 120 tonnes of plutonium at Sellafield.
Okay.
So there's a massive
amount.
There's
lots of that. But anyway, look, let's just focus down on Hinkley specifically for a minute, because we've just heard in the Financial Times that Brussels is going to probe a UK nuclear power plant deal. Brussels is, this is Guy Chazan and Alex Barker's article, launch a full investigation into whether the contract for Britain's first nuclear power plant in a generation offers illegal state support, casting the project into doubt until at least next summer. Joachim Alumina, EU Competition Commissioner, is preparing to announce the probe as early as next week, according to people involved in the case. deal that's under scrutiny is a contract signed in October between the UK government and French utility firm EDF for Hinkley Point C nuclear power station in Somerset. When built, it should provide 7% of the country's electricity. Agreement guarantees EDF strike price of £92.50 per megawatt hour, roughly double the current wholesale price of power for electricity produced at the £16 billion plant over a period of 35 years. So it looks like Brussels isn't having any of this, or at least is going to have a good look at it before they allow it to start, this deal between the British government and EDF.
Yeah, and here we go. This is the smoke and mirrors that's been going on about the nuclear project. So, nuclear came back on the coattails of climate change and was, the government promised that we would only do it if there would be no subsidy. And they are still denying the subsidy. But the fact that Europe have got to look at it is because it is a subsidy. And also, Tony, the government didn't sign any contracts in October. That article is incorrect. There will be no contract signed until it's been approved by Brussels. So all of the fanfare that when they announced the strike price, David Cameron coming to visit Hinkley, that's all to give people the illusion, to keep that illusion in place that this is a done deal, there's nothing you can do about it, it's all going ahead. EDF had planning permission to begin the build since March this year. Before they acquired planning permission in March this year, 2 years ago, they acquired planning permission to begin the groundworks because they argued climate change was such a terrible threat and so immediate that you had to start building it before you got permission.
But are you saying climate change isn't a threat?
No, I'm not saying it's not a threat, but I'm very cynical about the industry's claim. So, for example, if the climate change argument that they... Well, not the climate change argument, that's the wrong thing to... How do I phrase it? Climate change, obviously, is a very serious issue. And a lot of us who are opposed to nuclear power, what we've said all the way along is that if you're serious about climate change, nuclear power is not the way to go. They take too long to build. Do you know what I mean? They're never built on time.
Yeah, but they do deliver massive amounts of energy.
Well, actually, they're not a green solution, Tony. You know, the government don't like to look at the front end of the cycle or the back end. What they look at is how much carbon is produced when you're burning the uranium in the reactor. There is a massive amount of fossil fuel used in the exploitation of uranium. To get a piece of uranium the size of my fist, you are probably going to have to mine an area probably as big as a few of the buildings around here, just to get a little bit as big as my fist. You know, it's a massive amount of rock that they have to trash in order to get the uranium. Then you have to ship it around the world. You have to enrich the uranium, which is a hugely energy-intensive process. And then there's the waste. I won't even discuss how much carbon dioxide Sellafield uses, or how much gas it burns, or how much water it uses in keeping the waste cool. We do not know what the carbon footprint of the waste management over the next hundreds of thousands of years is going to be. So the claims that nuclear is green are completely unfounded.
Okay, so look, I'm going to put this $64,000 question to you. So what other forms of energy? Because I mean, what we're told is, anyway, whether it's true or not, difficult to know, but the lights are going to go out unless we have something like this very concentrated form of energy. And this is really the highest technology when it comes to power generation. You have one nuclear power plant will serve several counties.
Well, you know,
a wind farm won't do that.
The thing is, they can actually, Tony. And if you're going to look at Germany to see what's happening, if the lights go out in this country, it'll be because of the ineptitude of politicians, not because we don't have the technology available. We are 5 years behind in our thinking. This is what there's a guy called, I can't remember his name, he does the renewables world status report, and what he says is that we're 5 years behind in our thinking. So right now in the UK we're still talking about technology. Does the technology exist? Can we do it? That argument's moved on. It's no longer about that. There is more money being invested in renewables than fossil and nuclear combined. That is worldwide. In Germany there is a massive energy transition that has been well underway for over a decade. Germany gets a significant amount of its energy from renewables already. By 2050, I mean, like 5 years ago, Germany were projecting that they would be 50% 50% renewable by 2050, or achieving 50% of their carbon targets. I can't remember which one it was, but they're actually on target to smash that now. And this is just since that they've announced, you know, that they will turn off all of their nuclear reactors.
Well, another one of the things that the Germans are doing, of course, is actually decentralising their energy.
Yes, 50%
They're saying that each individual house is quite easy for them to be able to generate wind power, solar power, this kind of thing.
50% of the renewables in Germany are community owned, and this is the heart of it. Okay, this is the heart of the issue. The guy who, in Germany, who got through their Renewables Energy Act is a gentleman called Hermann Scheer, and what he said, and this is the battle that is going on, and it's going on in this country, and it's going on in Germany, and it's very, very evident. You've got the big utilities who like their big centralised power stations. They own the extraction, they own the power generation, and they own the distribution. And so they call it vertical integration in the industry.
It's a bit like the old Rockefeller family and their vertical integration in the oil industry, where they own the oil fields, they own the petrol stations that the oil was going to, they all owned the railways that were distributing their fuel, and they also owned the refining process. So if you own the whole thing, you can charge what you want.
Yeah, and this is the exact problem we're faced with. So all of the shouting saying that we can't do it, the technology doesn't exist, you can't do it, you can't cover the place in wind farms, it comes from, I mean, in this country particularly, it comes from the nuclear industry. And what I mean by that is, do you remember Margaret Thatcher? I'm sure everyone here does. Her press secretary, as was then, is a gentleman called Sir Bernard Ingham. And he is also a very big supporter of nuclear energy. And if you remember the politics around the miners' strikes, Thatcher wanted to smash the miners, and so she wanted to use nuclear power to do that. So they introduced the non-fossil fuel obligation, the NFFO. So they did that to smash the miners, and she, you know, she wanted a tranche of 10 nuclear power stations. But what happened was, in the introducing the NFFO actually also was an enabler for renewables. And so Sir Bernard Ingham started then attacking wind power. He set up a group called the Country Guardians. You can find out about this if you check out Corporate Watch or Spin Watch. You can find out about Sir Bernard Ingham and his connections with the nuclear industry and the anti-wind movement. He was the father of the anti-wind movement, and what a crap movement that is, excuse my language, in this country.
I just have to apologise to listeners for using that language. But the fact of the matter is that these wind farms also are actually very unsightly. People, I mean, we've just heard a Cotswold councillor talking about how a gravel extraction pit was set up behind his house, and he didn't want the a big bank of earth where the field had been. I mean, actually, for a lot of people, they don't want to see wind farms. They want a nice view without them. And in a way, they're rather like having a load of power pylons going past your house.
Well, all I can say, Tony, is you can't eat or drink a view. And it's not a question of not in my backyard. We are living in the times where it's a question of what in my backyard. Okay? We are faced with fracking. We are faced with nuclear. We have had 50 years of not living with the consequences of our energy consumption. We get to not look at where the coal is mined. We get to not look at where the oil is exploited from. We get to not see or experience the environmental damage that is done as a consequence of that extraction. Now, wind, even all of the renewable technologies involve some extraction. They're made out of metal, for goodness sake. But a wind farm, you can put a wind farm up, your cows can graze in the field around it. You know, when you've done with it, when you find a better way of generating electricity, you can simply remove the mast. Now, in this country right now, we're faced with nuclear, which we can talk about health and the impacts of that also if you want. We're also faced with fracking. One of the concerns about fracking is about radioactive pollution of the water. So you can't say that radiation is okay, you know, is a problem when it comes to fracking, but hey, it's good for you. When it comes to nuclear power, radiation is inherently dangerous. Ionizing radiation is dangerous. When you mine and you dig right down into the ground, you disturb processes that are going on that create that radioactivity and that are supposed to be kept separate from humans. So if you want electricity, if you want it, then you have to decide how you're going to generate it. Now, these people who don't want to look at wind turbines, you know, how long have we been looking at pylons and telegraph poles and all of the other utilitarian infrastructure that we're surrounded by?
Now, Martin, a couple of stories just over the last few weeks. Mark Leftley has been writing about the Hinkley debacle in The Independent. First of all, consultants pocketing £8 million in fees for the new nuclear plant in Hinkley, and also a fury over FTSE 100 blacklister Amex role in the £8 billion nuclear plant.
Well, I'm not actually familiar with those two stories, but I would point out that the economics of nuclear power have never stacked up. It's the elephant in the room. Why is the government subsidising something? We're told that we haven't got any money to pay for people to live in adequate sized properties and so on, but we're subsidising nuclear power. And of course, that's a non-market argument.
I mean, before anything's even happened,
before anything's even happened,
£8 million has been spent on fees to broker this deal, and we've just heard from Nikki that contracts still haven't been signed, and also blacklisted AMEC, their role in possibly building this plant. Just to explain why people might be worried about a blacklisting firm doing that kind of work.
Well, because when they come to build the plant, will there be fair employment practices carried out? On the construction, we know that 3,500 construction workers have been kept off construction sites over the last 15 years, denied work as a result of their trade union activities. And it shouldn't be a surprise that big organisations which are trying to dominate the political agenda like this are also the kind of organisations that engage in blacklisting of trade union activities.
If it's also uneconomic, as you say, why are the government still pursuing this?
Because what happens if you start funding an industry? I mean, we talked about nuclear waste earlier. The amount of money spent on nuclear waste management is enormous.
Yes.
It's absolutely
half
enormous.
Half of DEC's budget.
I've read stuff which I haven't got the figures at the top of my head. But I mean, they're talking about something like 2p in the pound on income tax to manage nuclear waste in Britain.
48 pence a day to manage nuclear waste in Britain compared to, I think, is it 12 and 14 pence for offshore?
So in other words, we're going through this whole social row and argument about how we're going to save money, the deficit's out of control, all the rest of it. Oh, we'll have to cut the welfare bill. That means that we're not going to pay people, give people decent housing, all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, 2p in the pence on income tax, in the pound on income tax, is being sent managing existing nuclear waste. People have no idea in this country what the money's spent on. They think it's all spent on single mums. No, yeah, it's spent on nuclear waste.
Nikki, yeah, can you just tell our listeners whereabouts we can find you online and whereabouts follow the campaign?
You can follow the campaign on, there's quite a few places. There is stophinkley.org. There is southwestagainstnuclear.wordpress.com. There is stopnewnuclear.org. There was quite a large number of anti-nuclear campaigning websites. Southwest Against Nuclear are based here in Bristol, and Stop Hinkley are based down in Somerset and in the Bridgewater and surrounding area. And Stop New Nuclear is a national umbrella organisation of many anti-nuclear groups working on weapons, working on waste, working on power, and all of those aspects, as well as groups like Rising Tide, who are committed to fighting climate change. So, you know, a lot of the people at the, I would say, the more grassroots end of things know that nuclear, you know, is not a good deal for the public.
OK, well, Nikki from the Stop Hinkley campaign, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time.
Thank you, Tony.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Also, how US and UK intelligence services are out of control. We hear now from an interview last week on a radio station, Voice of Russia, from former MI5 officer Annie Machon, how the intelligence services break the law with impunity.
It used to be called the Echelon operation, now seems to be called the Five Eyes operation. And it, of course, it's a problem because it circumvents the democratic laws of oversight in each country. And that also happens with Canada, Australia and New Zealand as well. So in the UK, notionally, they have to get a warrant, which is signed by a minister, in order to bug our phones. Obviously, tech has outpaced that anyway. And the same in the US. But of course, if they then spy on each other's citizens, they don't need warrants, and then they can just hand the information over. There is an incredibly close working relationship that has been since the Second World War between the US and the UK. And the UK likes it because it gives them a seat at the top table still. It's actually that intelligence relationship that allows them to punch above their weight internationally, much more than any other aspect of the relationship, the special relationship with the US, because of course they could put bases across the planet from colonies and things from the breakup of their empire, which then the US likes to use, and they value that very much. And from the Snowden disclosures particularly, we've seen that the NSA is funding partly GCHQ's work to a large amount, and GCHQ bosses, it now appears from disclosures, are very anxious to do the bidding of their new masters, which is, I think, how they should see the NSA. So they're prostituting the agency to focus on the interests of the NSA, which is rampaging, it's a mock, around the world, rather than focusing on what could be the more important work of protecting our national security.
Well, wide-ranging interview there with Voice of Russia by MI5 former officer Annie Machon, Martin. We're also hearing that one of the things that's going on with all this mass data trawl that these agencies are doing is that they're able to look into the future. Possibly, you know, organisations or activities might be made illegal. Then they can go back through the system and then catch people up as, call them terrorists or whatever, in things that at the time when they did them were perfectly legal.
Well, yes, but I mean, most of what they're doing is illegal. This is the whole point. GCHQ is clearly engaging in stuff which has not been given any legal mandate to do. That means it is, in fact, illegal. Now, we either have a rule of law or we don't. The NATO intelligence services have a track record of engaging in terrorism. They need to be police investigated, and everything should be under a rule of law.
Time to sign off now. No more SARS, the virus, or typical topical until after Christmas. Thanks very much for our guest in the first hour. That was Cotswold Lib Dem councillor Esmond Jenkins. Thanks also to Nikki from Stockhipley and the chap you just heard there, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. We'll be here with our alcohol-free sherry and mince pies in the usual time through Christmas and the New Year. Find us online at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down. I'll leave you this week with a song by Frank Sinatra. Of course, Frank Sinatra himself had connections with the Chicago Mafia, who it looks like were behind the assassination, at least on the ground, of John F. Kennedy. And this song came out just a few months after Kennedy's assassination.
Now this could only happen to a guy like me, and only happen in a town like this. So may I say to each of you most gratefully, as I throw each one of you a kiss. This is my kind of town, Chicago is.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, Nigella.